said that in the call.
In giving this class last week, I got a sense that there was some degree of frustration with Rabbeinu Tam, number one, about the approach to trying to compromise, you might say, our view of what Avodah Zarah is, what idolatry is, in light of the conundrums of living amongst a Christian society. And I also got it, stressfully, I got a sense in the course of the discussion that there was almost a binary approach or a binary system to either Avodah Zarah, either idolatry or your Judaism. And I think over the course of the class that we're about to speak about, and speaking about Islam, we're going to find that there are a lot of opportunities or other possibilities in between those two extremes. And I hope that in some degree this will be useful, both in our terms of our understanding of Islam itself, but also as far as our understanding of Christianity as well, to say that just because something is not Avodah Zarah, doesn't mean that it's MS, doesn't mean that it's true, doesn't mean that it becomes Torah. That when you say that Christianity is not, you know, idolatry, that doesn't mean that somehow that becomes equivalent with a true approach to God or a true approach to Judaism. So, yes.
With Elisha ben Avuya, was his sin also?
From with Elisha ben Avuya, it sounds like it was more an issue of a rejection of God. It seems like maybe apikorsu would be the word as opposed to shituf. As far as his dogmatic move, as it were. In other words, it's more like, from the description there, it's a rejection of the divine, and that's his attack.
Were there other religions that the rabbis also considered to be shituf besides Christianity?
In principle, there could have been others. In principle, there could have been others, although we found that Rabbeinu Tam specifically employs that principle for Christianity. So, let's begin about Islam as we began last week. What is Islam? Let's say get a sense out there. As we said last week, it's not just one thing. It's everything's different people. So let me get a sense of what we know about Islam here on the table before we jump into our discussion of it. Please. Any thoughts, comments? What is Islam? Yes.
Islam is a religion which began in Arabia in the 7th century. According to Muslim tradition, adherents called Muslims, Muhammad, who was then 40, received revelations over a 23-year period from the angel Gabriel, beginning with aspects of social justice and equality, and then the belief that there's no God but one God, and that Muhammad is his messenger, is more than a prophet, a messenger. There are the Quran, which is the holy scriptures of Muslims, have variety of prophets, various of whom are Jewish, and certain messengers, one of whom was Moses, one of whom was Jesus, one of whom was King David, as well as Muhammad, who's looked upon as the final messenger.
And what makes him unique as a messenger?
He's
the last one, number one.
The final.
But also, he writes without any degree of interpretation. In other words, he is a direct flow
from Gabriel to him, and from him to his fathers.
Or to the Quran itself. You know, the Quran is the direct expression. Right. Yes.
Islam is a religion of intolerance that wishes to subjugate the world.
Okay, so it's a very different perspective than we just heard. Okay, so one perspective of that is that Islam is about social justice. It's about receiving a monotheistic faith, of having, you know, a perspective of how man is supposed to live one's life. And then at the other hand, we have is a religion of intolerance and a religion of subjugation.
Violence.
Violence.
Yeah,
violence.
Those two.
The they're both true. Okay. I mean, I think, again, we have to, as we said in all our discussions, that in discussing a religion, it's very important to distinguish between the ideal of what that religion purports itself to be and what other people would see from the outside. Sort of the chatchila b'di'avad distinction. In other words, everyone looks at their own religion and sees it as the ideal form. You know, you think about Judaism, you think about Rav Soloveitchik, you know? When other people look at Judaism, when Noah Feldman writes about Orthodox Judaism, who does he talk about? Yigal Amir, Baruch Goldstein. So it's important to keep ourselves with some degree of perspective as far as what avenue we're looking at, because they are both true. Yigal Amir and Baruch Goldstein were Jews. So is Rabbi Soloveitchik. Yes?
Well, I don't know much about the origins of Islam, but I know that a lot of thoughts were borrowed from the religions that were prevalent at the time in order to sell Islam or make it comfortable for converts from other religions, especially.
That's going to be a very important point over the course of this understanding of Judaism and push to Islam, because Islam does incorporate elements from pre-Islamic cultures and even some degree from pre-Islamic religions as well.
And that he, when he, in trying to sell it to the Jews who were probably nearer him at the time, that part of the hostility came from the fact that he couldn't convert.
Okay, so there is a hostility between Islam and Judaism, yes?
Yeah, there's someone over here, I didn't hear exactly what he said, but it sounded violent. does Islam accept this second definition themselves as a definition of Islam? Violent? Yeah.
Islam, there are sections of the Quran that talk about fighting the polytheists.
I understand that. Sections about, yeah. But that's not my question.
So I mean, that's a question.
Does Islam itself accept that Islam is characterized itself as, when the rabbi asked about what is the definition of Islam, would a Muslim accept that as a definition of Islam as opposed to the first definition you gave about God being revealed, God's teaching being revealed to Muhammad over a 23-year period?
There are aspects of the Quran and there are aspects of Muhammad's sayings that talk of violence, and there are aspects of the Quran and aspects of Muhammad's saying that talk about peace, that talk about you can't force your religion on any other religion, on adherents of other religions. At the same time, there are aspects of the Quran that say you shall fight the polytheists unless they convert, and there are aspects of what they would do with Jews and Christians, who they don't force to convert, and historically didn't force, by and large, didn't force to convert, but required them to live a second-class life and pay an extra tax.
Right. I want to get to the essence of it.
Okay, so let me ask then to the more direct question. So what does it mean to be a Muslim? What's then required? What must a person do to be a Muslim? And we got a sense of history, we got a sense of some perspective in modern times of how very often we perceive them. If you want to say you want to be a good Muslim, what are the things you have to do? Pray five times a day, excellent. Hajj, okay, that's two out of five already, not bad. What else?
Fast during the month of Ramadan.
Number three, excellent.
Acknowledge the existence of only one God. And
that'd be the first.
That it is his messenger.
Okay, one left.
And the last is an alms.
Excellent. Very, very good. I'm impressed.
I would include killing non-believer.
Okay, so the Shia extends to three additional things. And it's not that you have to kill a non-believer, but it's It's the principle of jihad, which is about a sense of religious purpose in bringing God's presence or God's message to the world as in a larger way. So you may interpret that. But again, that's one of the Shia additional principles. That the one living a virtuous life, sort of like a Kedoshim Tihyu sort of principle. And then, a Sur Meirah principle is as their final, or their eighth key pillar of Islam. So, I can pass around to everyone here so they can at least see from a mother perspective what these five are. But I'm very impressed that you guys did your homework.
They could be for pushing up the point, but if the discussion is going, we need to, I think, in order to have a worthwhile discussion, we need to separate what Muslims say Islam is versus what kind of distorted or not distorted
perception.
Perceptions or, uncomplimentary things, or to put it nicely, like this last gentleman just said, to kill infidels, which is what, let's say, Jews would say about Muslims, but that's not exactly what I don't think they would say. Perhaps.
We were reading different, literature. I mean, what I read is I read about killing infidels. So
Islam today, I don't think Islam the reasonable leaders of Islam would say that one of their precepts to be a good Muslim is to kill the infidel.
Well, that's subject for for what we will learn about who is reasonable and who is not reasonable, what constitutes mainstream, what constitutes extremism. I'm offering the perspective that I've gotten on Islam today, and the question is, what is Islam? And the viewpoint that I'm offering is not one that's necessarily just my own, but one that is shared by many people who see Islam in these vile terms.
Okay, so I'm inclined towards trying to distinguish between what Islam says about itself and then what Islam in fact is. I think that is a useful set of distinctions. But again, I think that we have to give the same charitable request that we would have if someone was examining Judaism and not judging Judaism by Yigal Amir towards Islam as well. In other words, we have to give them the benefit of the doubt based upon their own understandings. And if that proves to be not true, practically, that's a different problem. In other words, everyone's going to distinguish between their ideal religion and then the religion that's practiced. But I
destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. God.
Right. I mean, obviously, you could do something really intense with Judaism also. If you wanted to read Judaism as an extremist religion that believes in the destruction of Amalek and is a people that believes in killing children and innocent children, you could have such a reading of Judaism. Now, that's not the type of Judaism I speak about from my pulpit.
We have nothing to apologize for in terms of the destruction of Amalek. We have nothing to apologize for.
Well, if you look at our text, I presume that if there were Amalekites hanging around the UN right now, they would want reparations for what we did to them in the times of Shaul. You know, that there's... Now, everyone has a history if you go far enough back, and we have this within our texts. You know, Rabbi Lichtenstein or I or any rabbi will not go back to the Torah and cross out the obligation to destroy Amalek. It's part of our tradition. Now, Islam also is going to have elements that are somewhat violent, as will Christianity or Judaism for that matter. You know, that they are part of what we are, and we need to discuss and relate to them, but we need to relate to them in context. And I think it's important that to not be too alarmist as far as our perspective of Islam as something which has existed over a vast amount of time. Islam does not just exist in this one moment, but exists over a long course of history. And also, it's very diverse. You know, the Islam in Indonesia is different than Islam in Iran, which is different than the Islam in Sudan, which is different than Islam in Morocco. So, are we going to be able to cover everything in the course of the next 45 minutes? Of course not. But I think we can speak about certain general principles about that. We can talk about how our rabbis throughout our history have responded to the theological questions that Islam poses to our people to some degree, not fully, but to some degree. And we can understand in some way how we interact with Islam as a Jewish tradition. Yes?
In asking these questions, one thing that I think we all realize is that Islam is not a homogeneous group, and it's not a monolithic group. So to really ask these questions, we're all familiar with statements that there is a difference between Sunni and Shiite, between Wahhabist and Alawite.
Sure.
And can we ask these questions without making these distinctions? Certainly, what Shlomo is stating is a perception, certainly of Wahhabism, as opposed to, let's say,
Sufism.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So I think that stating a question, but it's based upon...
They're all going to come back to the same Quran. They're all going to come back to the same five pillars or eight pillars if you're a Shiite. But you know, you're going to come back to certain key places. And as far as the questions that our sages have raised over the course of our history, they're going to be speaking very often in broad generalizations, sometimes not so correct, sometimes more correct, as far as how we as Jews interpret how Islam fits into the bigger picture. Now, for those who weren't here 2 weeks ago, we saw a very interesting statement by Maimonides at the end of Hilchos Malachim in Sefer Shoftim in the Yal Chazak in the Mishnah Torah. The Rambam says in the uncensored version that Christianity, even though it's idolatry, and Islam, even though it's not idolatry, is still part of a divine plan. And God's wisdom is beyond our wisdom, because you never would have thought this was possible. But God has created Islam and created Christianity in order to spread certain concepts throughout the world. And by spreading those concepts throughout the world, what would happen? When the time that Mashiach comes, Mashiach will knock on someone's door in Fiji. He'll say, I'm the Messiah. And sometimes in Fiji will know what Messiah, what the concept of a Messiah is. So says the Rambam. So now we're going to, with that introduction, get to look at a number of sources as far as Islam is status is related. And we're going to see a number of interesting applications to these ideas. So as we pass through the sheets, anyone going to be following the latest controversy concerning Heter Mechira? It's a Shemitah year this year. Now, you may not know this, but this has a lot to do with our discussion here today. Because one of the technical problems of the Heter Mechira is a prohibition about selling the land of Israel to Gentiles or idolaters. And there's a principle of Milut Tachanim. You cannot give free gifts to Gentiles. You can't sell the land of Israel to idolaters. However, this is not true for a Ger Toshav, which is a resident alien in the land of Israel who accepts the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. And part of this operation, the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, is that this individual, this person who's living in the land of Israel, must be a monotheist, must accept God, accept, some would say even more than that, you have to accept in some ways the revelation of the Torah to the Jewish people. And the same person must accept the rule of the Jewish people within the land of Israel. So one of the latest wrinkles in the Heter Mechira that somehow changed its the applicability as time progresses is whether the Arabs within the land of Israel today are the right purchasers for such a Heter Mechira. Again, the Heter Mechira says the person is not allowed to work land of Israel in the seventh year, in the Shemitah year. However, when the Jews came and resettled the land of Israel in the end of the 19th century, there was a great need to continue to farm the land year in and year out, otherwise the settlements would not have survived. So a number of rabbis, one of them, Rav Cook, allowed for the Jews to sell their settlements to Muslims. And one of the key principles was the fact that the Isur, the prohibition of Lot Tachanim, would not apply to them because they would have the status of a Ger Toshav. And with the politics today, whether the Muslims in Israel accept the state of Israel as being, you know, the proper government over the land, something which is has raised questions about the Heter Mechira even to another level, is whether this principle of Lotachanim would once again kick in as far as the Arabs are concerned. So that's really a Lamaisa question for our issue today. So I want to look at the Rambam's approach to the Arabs. And we're going to see here, our first source is a very interesting statement where the Rambam says that the Muslims have an even greater obligation than any other Gentile. And this has to do with the Torah portion from 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. Then in Parshas Chayisara, we learn about the people known as the Bnei Keturah. So let's look at the Rambam here in Hilchos Malachim, Perek Yod, Lachachas. Amru Chachamim, Shebnei Keturah, Shehem Zaru Shal Avraham. Our sages said that the children of Keturah, which are the descendants of Avraham, Sheba Achra Yishmael Yitzchak, were born after Yishmael and Yitzchak, Chayavim B'mila, they're obligated in circumcision. Behold, in his arvu, hayom b'nei Yishmael b'nei Keturah. And since at this stage, the children of Keturah have mixed in with the children of Yishmael, yitchayvu akol b'mila b'shmini. All Arabs are obligated in obligation to have a circumcision at when they turn 8 days old. Therefore, they are not punished for performing this mitzvah, because in the halachos says that in the halachos malachim here, the Rambam says that a Gentile cannot perform certain mitzvahs; they cannot pretend to be Jews; they cannot create some pseudo Judaism. However, Muslims or Arabs are permitted to perform, or even perhaps are required, the mitzvah to perform mila for an 8-day-old child. So this is, of course, a matter of dispute among other sages, but the Rambam here clearly gives or has a perception of Muslims which is of a unique status. So let's now look at where that the view of the Ishmaelim are concerned. Let's look at a shut of the Rambam. This is a shout to tshuva, a response of the Rambam, which you can find in Siman Tav Mem Chet. And it's important to remember that the Rambam, as far as this issue is concerned, wrote a number of very critical letters as far as the status of Islam to Jewish communities around the world, which were forced to convert to Islam at different stages. One of the Igeret Hashmad, which he wrote to some of the Jews in Morocco, when they were forced by an Islamic sect to convert during a period of, you might call it, Muslim fundamentalism. During his own period, and the question before him became: when you are forced to convert to Islam, you know, what does that then say about your status? What then is the implications of that? Do you become a full meshumet, a full person who rejects Judaism as a result of that act? Although the specific tshuva that we're going to look at right now is actually a tshuva which was written to Rav Ovadia Hager, a convert from Islam, who was questioning about the status of Islam to the Rambam. So let's look at this tshuva. Tshuva. Elu ha-Yishma'elim einan obey avodah zarah klal. The Muslims are not idolaters at all. Ukvar nechvetza ben pihem umilibam. And has already been severed from their mouths and their hearts. They properly reflect towards God an understanding of the divine unity. So he says that they do not have any image which they use to somehow belie the unity of God. They have an absolute understanding of the divine unity. And the fact that they tell lies about us, the fact that there is a polemic against the Jews. What were the Muslims saying about the Jews? What was the attack against the Jews? What did the Muslims say the Jews believe about? The Jews are true monotheists. We don't believe in one God, even though we say the Shema every day, twice. Western Muslims attack, because we somehow believe and falsely treat as the statement that God has a son. See, the Jews, about the Jews have a son. Just because they make this attack against us does not mean that we should somehow go and tell lies about them. And somehow go and say, you know, the tit for tat, they call us a Avodah Zarah, they call us idolaters, we'll call them a Avodah Zarah. Don't do that, says the Rambam. The Torah speaks about them. This is he is now attacking him. He says that this is exactly what Tehillim meant, that their mouths are speaking falsehood, and you know, the right hands are filled, or our right hands are falsehood. And the Torah also speaks about us. But we, the Jews, the remainders of the Jews, will not act in a wrong manner, and we will not speak falsehood. They will not find in their mouths some form of trickery. So now comes the Rambam, has a problem. Because there were people who, among the Jewish tradition, actually said that Muslims were idolaters. Why would someone have claimed that Muslims are idolaters? What would be the basis of such a claim? Always say, you know, were their five pillars, the Shahada, their testimony, which is that basically, I testify that there is none worthy of worship except God, and I testify that Muhammad is the messenger of God. This is their key statement. This is what they argue over and over again. So who can ever claim the Muslims are idolatry?
Well,
what happens in Mecca? What happens in Mecca? Everyone's seen the pictures of what happens in Mecca?
They bow
to the Kaaba. There's this big, big thing there. They walk around it. They bow around it. They do all sorts of funny. They throw stones. All sorts of wild stuff. Does this sound like a monotheistic faith? Sounds a little crazy. It sounds like idolatrous practices. Some have the problem, right? Be in Yomar Adam. People will say, in Mecca, they have a Beit Avodah Zarah. They have this thing, this Kaaba, whatever it is. There are idols inside, whatever they say about it. Avodah Zarah Tzafuna Betoko, and there's idols that are hidden within it. Shayu Ogdin Osa Abu Sehem, that their forefathers used to worship. But also Abayas, in that very same house of idolatry. Mabakak, says the Rambam. What of it? Elu Amishtachim Kenegdo Hayom, those people who bow and do the very exact act that their great great grandfathers who were idolaters used to do. Their intentions are only towards what? Heaven. This should remind us a little bit of what the language of Rabbeinu Tam was, reference to the Christians last week. When he's also used that same language of their intentions were for the God of Shemayim Va'aretz, the God of heaven and earth. Uklar Pirshu, Abathinus Akron Lebach B'Sanhedrin, Shemishtach Adam. Lebayit Avodah Zarah, v'hu savor shu Beit HaKnesset, hari libo masur l'shamayim. Our rabbis have already told us in Sanhedrin that if a person bows down to an idolatrous house thinking that it's a synagogue, he doesn't know about this. One of my colleagues in some far-off synagogue told me, he went to a shul, he thought this place was like a regular synagogue, they had a machitza in the place, it was all an upright synagogue, then it came to like Yizkor time. And all of a sudden, someone's like, "No, Rabbi, should we go pull out the statuettes?" He's like, "Statuettes? What are you talking about, statuettes?" Well, you know, every time we say Yizkor, we go to the back of the synagogue, we have a whole bunch of different statuettes, we're at the front of the synagogue, and, you know, we say that we leave and bring them out for Yizkor. He's like, "What? I never knew such a thing. You guys have statuettes that you bring out for Yizkor?"
Statuettes what?
some human form of some sort. He was telling me about this. I will not say which rabbi this was or which synagogue this was, but one of my colleagues in the United States of America, if you can imagine such a thing.
And what do these statues represent?
I have no idea. This is what these even happened to me. He got to the shul. He is called a study because it shows up as a young rabbi. They start bringing out the idols. So he was praying in the synagogue all this time, and now he says, let's get rid of the Avodah Zarah. Can you imagine? So, so the Rambam says the person's diving in a shul, he assumes that the place is a good, upright synagogue. All of a sudden he finds out, it's a base of Avodah Zarah. So what does the Gemara say about this? The Gemara says, Haredi b'masa l'shamayim, he had good intentions. He doesn't know about the Avodah Zarah. It's not his fault. How's he supposed to know that someone was fooling around with the Aron HaKodesh and was putting in a molech into the Aron HaKodesh? How's he supposed to know such a thing? So to the Muslims today, kulam taf nashim nichrasav lezam pihem v'tausam v'tipshutam v'dvarim acherim. So he says that the avodah zarah, even from the children and the women, has been fully removed. But rather, what is their mistake? This other shtos. Their mistakes, the tipshut, their foolishness, the dvarim acherim, but other things. But I can't write that in print because I'm living in a Muslim land. I'm going to get in big trouble. I can't write that in print. I'm like, what's wrong with these people? But that's a different problem. But they're not only Avodah Zarah, they have other issues. However, as far as the centrality of a single God, they are not made any error at all. Okay. So here we have the opinion of the Rambam. The status of the Muslims is that they're not idolaters. Now, the Rambam, of course, is responding to some people who say that in fact they are idolaters. And this was a view that was recorded in Masechet Sanhedrin. We'll see a quote by the Tzitzit Eliezer later in our shiur today. Quoted by the person who is called the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim on Sanhedrin, but in fact it was some other Rishon, in which this other Rishon said that the Muslims bow down to their prophets in their temples. Which of course is based on a misunderstanding of what goes on inside the mosques. But this is a view that is that was brought down in Judaism, and that's something that the Rambam is responding to. The Rambam is responding to those rabbis who look at Islam and say, well, they're bowing down to the Kaaba. They're doing something funny over there. Or they've taken on these forms of practice that are a reflection of idolatry. But the Rambam, as far as the vast majority of poskim is concerned, is the accepted view and really has become really universal to even both in the lands of the Muslim countries, also in Christian countries, that Islam is not idolatry. Now, what then is it? The Rambam says, well, it's tipshut. It's mistakes. They've also have other problems. But I think it's important, even without that, to look at the Rambam in Hilchos Machlokes Asuras to see a number of key distinctions the Rambam brings down as far as the status of Muslims are concerned. Because in Judaism, there's a whole set of prohibitions that relate to the concerns for idolatry among them. I get this question all the time in Westport. Rabbi, what could be non-kosher about wine? What could be non-kosher about wine? Grapes, squeeze them. Where's the non-kosher problem come from? So where did the problem for wine come from? A concern for idolaters who would come and utilize that wine for idolatry, and then once that principle is in effect, there are further gzeirot that go and tell us that even for stam yinam, even with wine where there's no assumption that there's going to have been any contact towards idolatry, there's still the prohibition known as stam yinam. Would such a prohibition apply for Muslims? They're not idolaters. Why would a Muslim ever take some any of our wine, or anyone for that matter, a wine that he's produced, and use it for idolatry?
Is that supposed to drink wine?
Even more than that. He's not supposed to drink wine at all.
Yeah, but he's a reformed Muslim.
Okay, but
I have heard, and I'm sure other people, that in the Catholic Church they were using kosher manashevitz kiddush wine for their sacrament. So they, so if that's true,
manashevitz.
Yes, isn't that? I don't know that. That's what
in Rome.
So it was sweet. No,
New York.
So if they,
an Italian would never utilize.
Nobody would ever utilize that, but. At times I heard that, so then how do you say to that?
I hope that they would not use even Mavushal Banashevitz wine, because you know then it would not, they don't Yotze their Chiyuv of Yisuch, you know, but
there's nothing we can do about it.
I'm going to tell you. Okay, well, let's go to the round. Let's go to the round that says about the status of Muslims. Okay? Let's look at this halacha here. This is above Machos Suros Perak Yudalef Lecha Zayin. Ger Toshav, a resident alien, who shekibel alav shevus of mitzvos, he, that's the person who accepts the seven mitzvos of Noah. We're on the first page, the front page. Second source, Ramam Hichos Machos Suros. I'm sorry, I didn't number them this week. This is the second source on the page which says, the prophet says, Moses, Muhammad, and me. Ger Toshav, Hush Kiva, Allah, Shemitz, Ismane Noach, Kemosh, be honest, we've explained, Yaino Asur, Ishtia, Umutubahana Ayah. His wine is prohibited to drink, as you cannot drink his wine, however, you can need benefit from it. You can't feed it to your animals, if you have an animal who needs to drink wine for some reason. You could sell it in your store. You can also have other good things with this wine. But you can't drink it. Mm-hmm. And you can leave your wine with him. However, you do not, you don't give it to him for a long period of time, which he becomes like somehow the guarantor over. So to any Gentile, this is one case where there's a problem with the gear thing, it's just to say any goy, it's not to say akum here. She'enu obin akum, who does not serve an idolatry, kegon elu ha'yishma'elim, like the Arabs or like the Muslims, yeinan asur b'shti'ah, their wine is forbidden to drink, however, it's permitted to gain benefit from. And so too, all the Gaonim, all the earlier sages who preceded the Rambam, had decided. Those really worship idolatry, their stamia wine that they produce, is prohibited for gaining any benefit from. So what we see from the Rambam and from the Gaonim, that even though a person is a Muslim, a person needs a ger tosha for the same matter, it doesn't mean that somehow you're allowed to drink their wine. Why not? Why can't you drink their wine? Is it not kosher? What's the problem? Why should I be drinking a Gentile's wine? The problem is that there's another issue beyond the consumption of wine, besides utilizing it for idolatrous purposes, and that is that wine is a facilitator of chevra. You start drinking with somebody, you get to know their deep, dark secrets. Mara says you know somebody by three things. You know them by koso, kaso, akiso. You know them by how they drink. You know them by what they're like when they're angry. And you know them by how they spend and use their money. You know, that's how you get to know a person really. What was that?
Why doesn't that apply to liquor? Why doesn't it apply to
There have been some rabbinic enactments as far as consumption of alcohol and of other types as well. In other words, there is such a prohibition. I'm not going to tell you how, as far as halacha lemaisa here, but there is a whole category of such a prohibition as far as consumption of other forms of liquor goes, for this exact reason of wanting to protect in some way our relationships so that we don't become too close with Gentiles. Now, how this applies in today's day and age where people are going out for business meetings all the time and, you know, the society is in a different place than it once was as far as some of those relationships, I'll leave that to your rabbi to discuss with you. But there are some halachot related to such issues. Yes.
Did you say by how they drink and how they get angry, or how they behave?
So that's a piece of the Talmud that speaks about the, if you really want to get to know somebody, you utilize those three tools.
And the
prohibitions on the rabbinic prohibitions about liquor, are they not to drink the liquor at all, or particularly, you know, drink it at a private, only Jews company, but not to drink it in company of non-Jews? Because here in the wine, it's not drinking the wine at all, even if there's no non-Jews around.
Right, that it's a function of that same desire that we do not interact socially in that way, and as a further separator, if you can't drink their wine, even when you're not with them, you're going to stay away that much further.
Of course, they could drink your wine when they're with you.
That is technically true, yes. They can drink your wine.
Well, that's for sure. They can still drink. I mean, I'm saying there's no way of separating us out.
The prohibition was not formulated in that way. That is correct. Okay, so just to review where we stand at the moment, we've noticed that the Rambam paskens that Islam is not a form of idolatry. However, the Rambam has been very particular, though, in stating that Islam is not the correct faith. It is certainly a form of, you know, a wrong system of belief. It might be monotheistic, but not all monotheistic forms of monotheism, you know, are Judaism. Judaism is a form of monotheism, but that doesn't mean that all forms of monotheism are Judaism.
Was it the Rambam's thesis that this is part of God's plan?
Yes, that was the Rambam's position. But now I want to even take it in reverse, you know, to push Islam one step further in the Rambam's thought, which is that there's a certain degree where Christianity has a leg over Islam. Christianity is better than Islam. Halachically, halachla ma'isa. That's where we look at our next shoot from the Rambam, our next response from the Rambam. Where you're going to find, even though the Rambam says that Christianity is a form of idolatry, he will still say that Christians are permitted to do something that Muslims are not, or that we're allowed to do something towards Christians that we're not allowed to perform towards Muslims. Okay, so the Hashayla, the very bottom of the first page. Mamar of Yochanan, Goy she'asek b'Torah chayav misa. A Gentile who studies Torah is obligated to receive the death penalty. Ha'im za halacha, is this in fact halacha l'maisa, is this in fact law? The statement of Rabbi Yochanan, v'achayav kol bar Yisrael lehimanea milamdo, is every Jew commanded to not teach Gentiles Torah, never mean a mitzvah or anything from the Torah, from the mitzvah, chutz mishev mitzvah olamido alayem imlav. Are you prohibited from teaching Torah to Gentiles? That's the general question. Let's see the Rambam's response. Hatshuva. Hi halacha v'lo safek. That is the law without any doubt. You are prohibited from teaching Torah to Gentiles. The ka'asher yad Yisrael tekifa alayhem, moninos san betalma Torah ad shisgayer. And when the Jews are in a position of strength, we do not allow Gentiles to study Torah until they convert. When they convert, they're allowed to study Torah. Before that, they're not allowed to. Aval lo yareg. Imasak v'Torah. However, a Gentile is not killed, certainly for studying Torah. Lefi shama chayav misa v'lo amar ne'arav. Because the formulation in the Gemara is, he's chayav misa. Chayav misa means he's deserving of death. It doesn't mean that he's killed for it. Okay, that's the Rambam's analysis. And now turn over the page. We're on the second side, at the very top of the page. Okay, there's no translation in English of this because I haven't gotten to the meeting part yet. This is all introduction. Okay, so now we're going to get to the meeting part. Now, Shkeim Shubizam, Shukivim Bizam, Vivar, the Divrei, Shuvazu, Nibli Rosa, okay, Kamush Amarnu, Sheva Mitzvos Ben Noach Narag. Okay. And Jenna was only killed for seven sins, and seven sins Ben Noach and nothing else. Umutar, Lelame, and Mitzvah for no trim. We are permitted to teach Torah. We're permitted to teach, this is now the bold part of that quote. We are permitted to teach Torah, teach mitzvahs to Christians. Ulamishkam al datenu. And to pull them, mashkam al datenu, to show them our faith. Ve'eno mutar davar zeh davar mizel ishmaelim. It is absolutely forbidden to do this for a Muslim. Do not teach Muslims Torah. Lefimash yadu alachem al minasam. Based upon what is known to us about their faith. Shetorah zu eina min hashemayim. Because our Torah, as far as a Muslim is concerned, is not from heaven. Mekashe yilam dum, dvar min ha tubeha. when they begin to study some of the stuff that's written in our wonderful Torah, what they find? Misnaged lemasha badu heimilibam. Lefi irvu hasipurim ubilbua inyanim asher bo lahem varei lotia zur ayaslam shekaus pidehem. Because when they begin to study, so they immediately will oppose whatever is written in our Torah, because based on what they've chosen of their own heart, and they come up with what they've invented, and based upon how they've confused all the different stories in the Torah, based upon their Quran, which is all a bunch of mishmash, they're going to end up not seeing any form of evidence for the truth from studying our Torah. Masha'in Cain, the Christians. Because Christians accept the Torah as coming from Shemayim. Christians love to study the Bible. And the Rambam says, good. The Christians already accept the Torah is coming from heaven, so they should learn a little bit more. And if they learn a little bit more, eventually they come to realize that their pshat in Yeshaya is totally wrong. They come to learn that their pshat in Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov is totally wrong. And eventually they come to appreciate what the real Torah is. Because this won't work for a Muslim. Because the Muslim has taken the Torah, they've mishmashed it all the way up. They don't even going to come from God anymore. Yes?
So, Islam does not believe there is any such thing as the five books of Moses or the Old Testament?
Of course they do. So what's the Rambam? The Rambam here is not relating to that. He says that they've taken the Torah and they've mixed it up and mishmashed it. In other words, the Quran basically says that there were all these earlier prophets. Moses was one of the earlier prophets. Abraham was one of the earlier prophets. Joseph was one of the earlier prophets. Jesus was one of the earlier prophets. But they were okay. They tried to work with the people at the time. But they had, you know, and they corrupted it a little bit. The people that weren't really able to hear them in the right way. It got lost in translation, or lost in transmission. And it's not the real deal. The real deal is the Quran. That is the inerrant word of God direct to a person who could not, an illiterate man who through an absolute miracle was able to transcribe the Quran and transmit it perfectly to his believers, and that is their belief. So
do they believe the same about the New Testament? That is a mishmash?
Yes.
So there is no...
No. They've taken it and created a mishmash out of it. Because the Rambam says they made a mishmash out of the Torah.
So, but no one knows, according to Islam, no one knows where this original Torah, the original Torah is...
It doesn't matter. The Quran is that original truth.
Okay. In Islam, the Quran is the only holy... Bible.
It's the only true, absolutely true source.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean that Moses was not a prophet. That doesn't mean that Moses didn't communicate with God.
From what I read, it seems to me that the Muslims believe that the Torah was given by God, but it was corrupted by humans. For example, when Abraham referred Yitzhak over Ishmael, this is something that the Jews made. The original Torah said that Ishmael was the preferred child.
And that's what they have in the Quran.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but Isaac and Jacob are both referred to as blessed in the Quran.
Doesn't the New Testament supersede the Old Testament also?
Not, well, for the Muslims, presumably to some degree, but in a way, it's insufficient.
For the Christians.
For the Christians, yeah, that was last week's class.
No, but
nearly. I think for his perspective, for the Rambam's perspective on the Christians, the Rambam's going to say, well, that just because they believe that the New Testament was superseded by the New Testament superseded the Old Testament, does not mean that they don't accept the Old Testament. The Old Testament still remains the Word of God, and as a result, their study of the Old Testament still has value per their faith system, and as a result, it's worthwhile to teach them Torah, so at least they can come to the true understanding of what God really revealed.
So, and a Muslim will not study the Old Testament.
That's correct. That's correct. So then we see from the Rambam a very interesting sort of contradiction there, where the Rambam is saying to us that even when you say that Islam is not in a form of idolatry, But Christianity still has a leg up on it as far as its receptivity to teaching, or being, well, he used the word moshech, being able to draw them towards our faith. The Rambam sees a value in teaching the Torah to Christians, which of course was a very good Jewish profession in the Middle Ages, where many Christians wanted to study Hebrew. They wanted to come and go and discover things.
Is that first sentence sort of condoning proselytizing to draw them to our faith as opposed to teach them our faith? Draw them seems to have, I don't know what the Hebrew word is, but...
It's Moshech. Moshech is a sense of bringing close.
Okay, so I thought Jews do not believe in proselytizing.
Jews do not believe in proselytizing. That's a question over time. Also a question of context.
What do you mean by proselytizing?
Right.
Trying to actively... convince someone.
I mean, it's certainly true of the conversion.
Mr. Rizkin gave a whole lecture here last week to the Jewish experience, in which he basically was talking about the an obligation of the Jews to bring the mission of Hashem to the world.
Rizkin Rizkin's involved with a number of these Christians for Israel organizations, and you know, he's really, in some ways, he's taking from the Rambam, this very Rambam, which talks about the value of somehow interacting with them and being moshech them through study of the Torah, is in some ways his perspective. Now, there are many rabbis who would disagree, and they would take a more conservative, lowercase c approach to those interactions. As far as the process of conversion goes, though, there absolutely is a point to the process of conversion where we tell a convert, you know, we try to discourage the convert during the course of the process.
Right.
Now,
you go like this.
Exactly. In other words, there's a given thing. We wanted to test the degree of commitment, but we really believe in our Torah. The way the Rambam describes it, what's the sign of truest love? Rambam in his book Ava talks about this. The sign of true love is that a person cannot help but talk about and spread and share that love with everyone he sees. He met the most wonderful woman. And he can tell everyone about that person that he's met. And the Rambam says the same thing is true of God as well. That if a person is totally enamored and totally overcome with the love of God, he's going to share that. And that's an expression of the love itself. A person truly loves God, they're going to share and spread that love with others.
Is that what he meant, Rambam? Like he would want to have a good debate with a Christian and get them to see the Jewish viewpoint from the sake of integrity and truth, and not necessarily to convert the Christian? Or would he say, no,
as far as our vision of the end of days, in the Rambam and others also, we basically believe that, there will come a time when everyone will come and recognize us. Now, how that's achieved, that's a different problem. Now, we're not going to go out with our swords and our guns and try to convince people of it using those mediums. But fundamentally, we believe that we are an Orlegorium, and we believe that in a Messianic era when everyone will come to appreciate God's unique quality and the role that we've played in the transmission of the Torah through time as a means of God's communicating with mankind.
From his perspective, did he want to convert people to Judaism in his day?
No.
As part of his mission?
No, he says that clearly by his reference to Islam. He lived in the Islamic country, and he said that, no, you have no business going and trying to pull the stuff off. He wasn't interested in it. In that age.
Mm-hmm. He himself might have converted to Islam.
The Rambam?
The Rambam.
There's a whole question when he was in Morocco whether he was a pseudo Muslim or not.
Yeah.
It's not at all clear. It's really not clear.
Rabbi Sheikh gave us a speech last year, and he said that Bernard Lewis came out with certain proofs which seemed to be conclusive.
But the Rambam, in fact,
the Rambam at least pro forma.
When he lived in Morocco.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was doing research for his next book.
No, the story is that when the Rambam was already important person at the court in Cairo, that a Muslim appeared from Morocco, and he said,
and he pointed to him and said he
looked at him as a
Muslim.
A Muslim. And that the law of the Muslim,
a person of a Muslim cook becomes a Jew, he's a Chayav Nisa.
And he was only saved by the Amir who liked him and pointed out that something apparently they have also, if it's done against your will, if it's forced upon you, you are not responsible. And Bernard Lewis
found some evidence of this from the courts, and very interesting. Okay, so that's what we have so far as far as the Rambam is concerned. And again, this is the standard view of Judaism as far as the status of Muslims are concerned, not idolaters, but again, not true, not what we believe, not our faith is concerned. We saw that the Christians have a leg up as far as their acceptance of the Torah to some degree, whereas Muslims do not have that degree of acceptance of the Torah, such that we would teach them the Torah. Now I want to look at a different view from the Rambam. And this is from the Radvaz. And this is going to again bring out the point about just how significant is this distinction between Judaism and Islam as far as our faiths go. In other words, what is the status of a monotheistic religion that's wrong, or that has wrong understandings of the nature of revelation? So we'll look at the Radvaz here. Sheilat nimani al inyani kari adat al eivle cheshbon ani maskim al Rambam zal or al Rav ben Chasdai or al cheshbon Rav Yosef Albo. So the question of whether there were a certain number of principles of faith, how many were they, what were they, and someone asked the Radvaz, so do you agree with the Rambam? Do you agree with the Chasdai Kreskas? Do you agree with Rav Yosef Albo? Different systems, 3, 13, also different systems. Tshuva, Ein da'ati maskemet l'shum l'toratenu atnima shum yikar l'fisha kula yikar mipi agvura. I don't believe in any forms of principles. I don't believe in any form of somehow distilling the key principles of faith. You gotta believe everything. The Torah in whole. I'm not going to break it up into little nice little slices so that you can teach them at an MJE event. That's not the way we're going to do it. We're going to give you the whole Torah as one big piece. Everyone who says that the entire Torah is true except for one verse, that person is not a believer, that person is not a Jew, if he tries to accept the Torah excluding a single line. If that's so, kol mitzvah mitzvah hi yikar, then every single mitzvah itself is a reflection of the ikar of the Torah. You cannot say that this principle is more important than the other principle. You can't philosophize about the Torah. The entire Torah is truth, says the Radvaz. Everything has its reason and its logic that you cannot fully understand. How can you go and say that this principle, that's the main principle? To believe that there's one God, that's the main thing. How do you know? Everything's important. Kalut dvarim yafeh kasa b'zeh Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel. Abarbanel, Yitzchak Abarbanel says, "V'sefer Rosh Emuna, Ayin Sham, ki hu alich v'yerchiv adibur v'yishiv al-rishonim, v'chein hu da'ati sh'ator kol pratzav d'idukal, kol echa mehen ikar." Everybody, the Torah is the ikar. Everything is the principle. The yisod. Ufina. V'amakhish oto nikra kofer. Anyone who rejects any of that is a kofer, is a person who rejects, has no right to the world to come. Now we get to our issue. For this reason, the person is forced to violate any of the mitzvot in the Torah. But Omram, when those who force this person to reject that mitzvah are doing so with the perspective that this was not commanded by God, or it was only temporary, it was only until a certain individual came onto the scene where these mitzvahs applicable. If that's what a person forces you to accept, it's already passed, you know, it's vitiated, no longer necessary. Yahareg v'al yavor. Such a situation, what should you do? You should submit to death rather than violate a single mitzvah of the Torah if it's based upon the principle that you reject that mitzvah as coming from God. course, everyone knows only three things do you really, three mitzvahs you're required to give up your life for. What are those three mitzvahs you're required to give your life for? Idolatry, and murder. So, everything else, Shabbos, for example, person tells you, violate Shabbos or we'll kill you. What are you supposed to do? Violate Shabbos. That's halacha. You have to violate Shabbos. But he just seems to say that don't violate Shabbos if it means rejecting the principle of Shabbos. So he says that principle that we said Yahweh Val Yahareg, that a person should violate Shabbos rather than be killed, that was only said El Kishomim Lo, when the Gentiles tell you Halel Shabbos, desecrate the Shabbos, La'avor Al Datzecha, so as in order so that you disgrace your own religion, but without any principled perspective that you now adopt a new system of faith. V'chein Kasav HaRitva, and this is also what the Ritva said. The person is forced to become a Muslim. What should he do? He agrees that the Rabbah says they're not idolaters. Even though they're not idolaters, what should you do? Yahareg the Yavor. Submit to death. And do not violate the principle of Shabbos. Do not violate the principle of Kashrus. Whatever the case might be. And that appears to be my, I agree with that view, says the Radvaz. This is an extreme view. The Rambam does not hold this. When the Rambam was writing to the people of Yemen, when he's writing to the people of Morocco, that's not what the Rambam said. But the Radvaz takes upon this perspective that even a monotheistic faith, if it requires a rejection of our core principles of the uniqueness of the Jewish people, of the uniqueness of Torah Min HaShamayim, that's what it requires, says the Radvaz, better to die and not violate it. So again, we see that even with the perspective of Islam, that does not assume that it has a status of idolatry, there's a view within our tradition that says that doesn't mean it's okay. It doesn't mean that somehow this is not somehow less severe a trespass to somehow accept them on whatever level. The Ravas here is advocating for the same principle of martyrdom as existed in Christian Europe. Yes.
They deviate
to
the same kind
of later.
Because the Rambam was much more lenient.
Of course. Basically, he doesn't even quote the Rambam. It's amazing. He doesn't quote the Rambam. The Rambam is like, that's a commentary on the Rambam. He doesn't bother to quote him here. It's amazing.
Where
does
he live from?
The Rambam is? I'm actually not sure. I should have... I'll get that information for you for next week.
No,
I apologize.
He doesn't live in the Arab area, does he? The Christians, the ones that lived in the Christian more severe than
the one. But the thing is that those living in Christian countries, typically, the Ravans is an exception. Most of the Jews living in Christian countries say that the Muslims are not idolaters, mm-hmm. and that they would take the Rambam's view as far as conversion is concerned. In other words, that it does not necessitate this degree of martyrdom. Ravans is a unique view in that respect, yes.
Why did he say what he's saying? He said you're only supposed to
because he says that when you die for only for those three things, that assumes that, excuse me, when you do not die for all the other 610 things, is because the Gentile asks you to violate that so as to provoke your religion. In other words, he wants you to somehow show yourself to not be a Jew, but not to somehow accept some other form of faith and somehow reject the principle behind the Judaism. Whereas a person somehow... What was that?
Is that the halacha?
That's what he says the halacha is going to be, yeah. So he would say, if a person... Do we follow him? We should never have this at the basis in our lifetime, but... We would buy. I do not rely on either Pesach or Shilas for such things. But over the course of our history, I think we typically followed the Rambam's perspective as far as this goes.
Don't
if we had questions of the Rambam, then
go to the Rambam, go to Moshe Feinstein.
Moshe will come to Moshe Rabbein. From here we learn the Halacha Rambam. No questions. This is what my rabbi told me.
That we certainly follow the Rambam in the vast majority of cases, but even the Beit Yosef would not pass the Rambam across the board. The Rambam, the Beit Yosef would sometimes pass against the Rambam, based on a system where you would utilize the Rush and the Riff, sometimes pass against the Rambam. So the Rambam is the great master, and certainly we follow the Rambam in many, many situations. But there are other views that are out there. He says it's idolatry, and therefore a person would be responsible to Yahweh Bal Yavor.
So that's Yahweh Bal Yavor, but not
Israel. Yeah.
It would seem that in some of the Hanukkah stories that they give power more according to the Rabbi.
As far as Islam is concerned?
No, not the religions, but just the idea that it doesn't have to be one of the three most serious crimes in order to submit to death.
Right. Well, there's a principle
of like not eating kosher, which normally is not a reason to.
There's a principle in common with Gzeiras HaShemad, or in the time of Gzeiras HaMalchus, when the kingdom were trying to persecute the Jewish people to now uproot Judaism or destroy Judaism. In which case, as you said, if there are things other than the big three, a person would be obligated to give up his life to protect the principles of Judaism. That is correct. I see we're over time again. There's a tshuva that Tzitzel Yazir here, which I think is worthwhile to have a quick look at. Tzitzel Yazir is a writer in the 20th century, still alive today, thank God, and a writer of many, many tshuvot. And he writes about going to mosques and going to churches. So he says churches, obviously, obviously can't go into. Then he goes on, he utilizes the piece from the Ran, or the thing is meaningless to the Ran, to utilize to it's forbidden to go into mosques. Going back to that other principle, he's interesting to see this even Lachlan Mice today going against the Rambam. They bow down to this false prophet, Shalom. Therefore, for their mosques have the status of idolatry. So the Tzitzel Yazir says it's forbidden to go into mosques, utilizing this logic. So as far as the conversation between Islam and Judaism goes, there's a large bit of halachic orientation towards them that we got a chance privilege to see as far as the Rambam was concerned, as far as the Rabbaz was concerned. And this is, of course, a function of periods of confrontation between the Jews and Islam throughout the course of their history. And our perspective on Islam is informed by our categories as halachic Jews who see the world in the prism of halacha. And it's informed also by our experience through our history, where Jews have had a long history of living amongst the Muslims. And we have to be honest with the fact that throughout a large portion of our history, it was much better off for a Jew living under Muslim rule than living under Christian rule. Now, how that affects our perspective today, how that affects, you know, whether we do Hetzer Mechira in Israel or not, you know, that's something that's informed by all these various factors. And we respond to Muslims both in times of peace and in times of war, and we have to appreciate them for what they say about themselves and what they actually believe. And there are periods of misinterpretation where we understand them incorrectly. And I think we see that in some of the tshuvot that we saw as far as understandings of what takes place within a mosque. Sometimes Jews will understand that something is being a worship of the prophet, which is really not a worship of the prophet. It's a misinterpretation that still gets brought down in halacha, it still gets codified, even to the extent that it says Eliezer would bring this down in halacha today as far as how we treat mosques. Now, the Tzitzel Yazir, again, is not the predominant view as far as this goes, because he's built upon an opinion of a Rebbe Nissim that is not the authoritative view. But it's all built upon how we look across, how we understand their faith, based upon our knowledge of the other. Any questions? Yeah, thank you.
What's next?
Next Tuesday, I believe, is Buddhism. Although next Tuesday, we're off. Next Tuesday, we're off. We're going to be back on again the following Tuesday. Yes. I think in the schedule, online, and also the schedule at first, just my class. Just my class. That was on honor of Thanksgiving traffic.
It's Thanksgiving traffic. No.